This is a case about a college student who got into a car crash and vanished.
No one knows what her destination was. So then, you know, her car is found on the side of the road. The police are called, the police show up, and she's gone.
That's Julie Murray, sister of missing Mara Murray.
One of the draws to my sister's case and why so many people around the world follow it is because we know so little.
For years, Julie has had to become a detective herself, trying to solve the case and find her sister. And now on the 18th anniversary of her disappearance, the FBI has issued a nationwide alert, placing the case in VICAP, the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program.
Is there anything new in the case?
Before we dive into the case, I want to remind you that this is for mature audiences and still might not be for everyone. Also want to thank you, investigators, for writing reviews on Apple Podcasts and sharing the episodes. It's a way for you to be a part of the podcast, and the reviews really help independent podcasts like this one get noticed. So let's investigate the disappearance of Mara Murray. Investigators, you're on deadline.
From the Hollywood Hills to your ear holes, this is True Crime Deadline. A podcast discussing cold cases, murder mysteries, and completely random thoughts. Now, here's your host, a man who stands in front of crime scene tape and talks on the TV box for a living, Mr. Mystery himself, Matt Johnson.
Investigators, thank you for joining me for episode 36, Mystery, The Disappearance of Mara Murray. The first episode in this limited season 3. It's been a big year already. You may have caught me on shows like Oxygen or ID Channel and even Court TV talking about cases that I've covered and that still haunt me today. Cases like this one, because it's a case that is so solvable. Someone out there knows something.
Tell me about Mara. What is she like?
Yeah, I mean, she was fun-loving, really enthusiastic, standout athlete. She broke every record in middle school, up into high school in terms of mid-distance and long-distance running, destroyed the records and made it to all the highest level state meets and sectional meets, and went so far as to go to U.S. Nationals in the 2 mile as a sophomore in high school, which is incredible. And she finished 33rd in the entire nation as a sophomore. Incredible athlete. But not only that, she was so smart, extremely intelligent. She scored almost a perfect score in math on her SATs in high school. So wow. She got a 1420 in math. So, you know, she got that. She got those genes. I did not. So when I was at West Point and I'm in my calculus class, I would call back to my little sister in high school and say, "Mara, can you help me with this math problem?" And she'd be like, "Julie, you're an idiot. Like, do this, da da da." And I'm like, "Perfect, thank you." And so she was getting offers to go to really great schools when she was a junior in high school, to include Harvard, you know, Brown, Princeton, all of those. But I sort of sold her on how great West Point was. And so she's like, "Okay, I'm going to go there." And I didn't realize that she wasn't going to love that structure and getting up early and marching around and the physicality. But that wasn't for her. So I sort of like, "Oh man, maybe I should have like told her everything that we had to do." So, you know, Mara wanted to help people. She would always write little things. She would always write thank you notes, no matter what you did. If you, you know, even if you did the smallest little gesture, she'd write you a thank you card, and it would be, you know, not generic at all. It would be well thought out. And she always wanted to do things for other people. And, you know, that's one of the things I miss most about her, is that. And she was really funny. You know, she made you laugh. And of course, I miss that about her as well. But the thing I miss most about Mara is the fact that I have to I've had to go through my life without my best friend. You know, like I go through life events and she's not there. And, you know, our sister Kathleen just passed away and Mara wasn't there. And that's sad. Yeah. It's sad that, you know, you grow up and you, you know, you've got this little sister who's sort of a built-in best friend. Like she can't go anywhere. She's always going to be your sister. So you got a best friend for life. And that was taken away from me.
Right, because that life has paused because she is always at that age and you've missed out on all these memories together. So I'm sorry.
It's hard because in normal losses, not normal losses, but, you know, in situations where you have a death or, you know, it's just a sibling or loved one pass away and you know, you can go through the grieving process. So you can go through those steps.
Because there is closure.
Because there's, it's not unresolved. So for my family, it's ambiguous. So you're exactly right. It's like, she's frozen in time and I've said it before, like I can never go confront someone and say, you know, what you did to my sister is horrible, but over time I'll forgive you. Cause I don't know if that's even true. I don't know what happened to her. So I can't confront, the source of my loss, the source of my trauma. So it's this, the cyclical grief rumination constant in my head that I try to deal with, but it's hard when you can't direct it at anything because it's just unresolved.
I recently sat down for a brand new interview with Julie Murray, sister of missing Mara Murray, and I couldn't help but notice the resemblance.
It's sad not having her around because she really did make everyone laugh, lighten the mood. I mean, her smile would light up a room. She had these amazing dimples and when you look at pictures of her, you can always identify her with the beautiful dimples that she had.
And the dark hair and the light complexion. And she was about 5'7" from what I read, but I noticed that you look alike.
Yeah, we all of us do sort of. We're a good mix between my mom and my father. But I would say Mara looked a little bit more like our mom. Yeah.
On February 9th, 2004, nursing student Mara Murray submitted her homework electronically. With it, she emailed her professors with a lie that there had been a death in the family. She called a condo in Bartlett, New Hampshire, and packed a bag with makeup, school books, and several days' worth of clothing. Around 3 that afternoon, she withdrew less than $300 from an ATM, stopped at a liquor store, and didn't tell anyone her plan. Around 7:30 that night, Mara crashed her 1996 Saturn in Haverhill, New Hampshire, airbags deployed. A bus driver who lived nearby spoke with Mara and then called police. When police arrived, the car was locked, some of the alcohol was missing, and Mara was nowhere to be found.
So you have been dealing with this mystery for quite some time, right? This all started to unfold and became a nightmare for you, I would imagine, right away in 2004?
Right. It was February 9th of 2004. My family didn't learn until 24 hours after her car was found on the side of the road.
What do we know about that night? What do we know? What have we learned?
Well, one of the draws to my sister's case and why so many people around the world follow it is because we know so little. You know, the police know a little bit more than the family, and the family knows a tiny bit more than the public. But it's still not much at all. So we know that Mara was a nursing student at University of Massachusetts, and she emailed her professors on a Monday morning and said, "Hey, I'm going to be out of town. There's a death in the family," which there was not. And she didn't tell anybody, and she emailed her homework to her professors, and then she went to the ATM, got pretty much all of the money left in her bank account, and so she was a poor college kid that was only $280, and went to the liquor store, and then jumped in her beat-up car and headed north without telling anybody. And the next thing we know, there was a couple of witnesses that said, "Hey, there's a car off the road." And this was 7:30 at night on that Monday up in New Hampshire. And so my family, we don't know why, she didn't tell us why she was going up there. So that's part of the mystery. No one knows what her destination was. We know that earlier the day, that in the day, she did call 1-800-GO-STOW, I assume for lodging, but she was not able to secure any lodging. And she did also make another call to a condo that my family and I used to stay at in Bartlett, New Hampshire. But again, she didn't make secure any lodging. So it's a mystery as to why she was up there in the first place. So then, you know, her car is found on the side of the road. The police are called, the police show up, and she's gone. And that's...
Was there enough damage to the car to where she may have been injured?
Yes. Yeah. So there was a crack in the windshield on the driver's side, and both airbags deployed. From what I know, from what law enforcement has told my family, there was no sign of struggle at the vehicle, no blood or anything like that. But it's concerning to me that the windshield was cracked, because that could mean head damage, you know, maybe a concussion or shock. So the car was drivable. Like, she could have driven it away. But we don't know.
What did she hit?
She sort of went down. She spun out. This is based on the police report. We don't know for sure, but the police report indicate that she spun out, went down into a little ditch, and then hit a snowbank. And so there's a lot of controversy over whether she hit a tree or she hit the snowbank. So the snowbanks up there were, it had snowed previous to that, and it was probably about a foot, maybe 2 foot, 2 feet high. So the car went into the ditch and then hit the snowbank.
Is there a possibility that she could have hit another car and that driver may have tried to take her somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, that's a thing, that this is a storyteller's dream, because anything is possible. She could have hit a car. Some people have speculated that she hit a tow hitch based on the way the damage to the car looked after it was found. But we don't know.
So is there any paint of a different color where her car was damaged?
No paint of a different color. It was sort of indented. The hood was kind of pushed forward. But like I said, that it was drivable. She could have driven it.
Right, because there was no flat tire or anything, or was there?
No.
Okay. So I'm assuming that there has also been searches in that area, because if someone hits their head and they don't know where what they're doing or where they are, they could get stuck in the snow. I'm sure that there's been searches since in that area.
Yes, significant, extensive searches. So the key result of the searches were that there were no footprints in the snow. So we can assume that she did not leave on foot, because she would have left footprints. So the week of February 9th, there was Fish and Game that was called in, and they did an extensive search all around the area on foot with scent dogs. Didn't find anything, no belongings, nothing, no footprints. They also had helicopters looking for heat signals, the technology that allows them to identify, you know, animals and humans based on the heat that they're putting out. But they didn't find anything.
Is there any lakes nearby or any place that you would have liked to have seen search sooner?
I would have liked the entire search to start sooner, because Mara went missing at 7:30 on February 9th, which was a Monday. My family got the call Tuesday evening. So that's a full 24 hours, roughly. And so we lost a huge chunk of time where, you know, the window that we could have found her was that window. And so by the time my dad was in Connecticut at the time, he was closest and jumped in the car and was up there at dawn on Wednesday morning. And he went to the police station and he said, okay, how are we progressing with the search? And there was no search. So my dad showed up and he was the search. And so that was disappointing for my family to learn.
I'm sorry to hear that too. That is so critical that there were so many hours lost right away when you have a missing person, potentially injured or potentially kidnapped, or as you say, we just don't know, you know? I mean, who were the people that reported seeing her or reported the accident, and what do we know about them?
Right, so there was a older couple that lived directly across the street from where her car spun out. They were the first ones to call 911. They said that they heard a loud thud, looked out their window and saw a vehicle, and they called 911, and that was at 727. They did state that they said that they saw a man smoking a cigarette. So that's another piece of mysterious information, because we don't know who that man was. And they later said, well, we didn't mean a man. We meant it could have been a man. So it's confusing. So there was confusion from the minute that the call was made. And then a bus driver who lived about 200 meters down the street was driving home. He had dropped some kids off, high school kids, I think, at a ski event. And he stopped by the Saturn and he talked to my sister and said, hey, are you okay? Do you need me to call? You know, do you need help? Do you want to come back to my house and get warm? And allegedly, my sister said, no, I'm okay. I've already called AAA. But we know that was not true because there was no cell phone service in the area. And there still really isn't any cell service up in that area today. So that bus driver went back to the house knowing that there's no way she could have called AAA. And she probably was, you know, in shock and didn't know what to do. And this man approached her and she didn't know this guy. And she's in an unfamiliar area and probably shaken up and declined. He called in to law enforcement as well. So law enforcement arrived about 7:46. And when they arrived, the car was locked and she was gone.
Did they find her keys?
No.
Okay, so I want to dissect what you just mentioned right there and the timeline of these people. So it's an older couple living across the street where Mara's car is, right? They see a man or a woman smoking. They see a man. Let's just go with our first instinct, probably a man. Did the bus driver smoke?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know the bus driver smoked. I don't think so.
Did Mara smoke?
Not that I know of. Mara was a distance runner. My whole family were distance runners, so that's not something that would...
What did she buy at the liquor store that day?
She bought a lot of liquor. She bought ingredients to make a Black Russian, so that would be vodka, Kahlua. She had some sky blue wine coolers, and then a small little, you know, those little $2 nips of Bailey's. And she had previously bought a box of Franzia wine. She purchased that on Saturday because she went to a party at her dorm room on Saturday. Now that was opened already in the car, behind the driver's seat.
So the alcohol that she purchased at the liquor store, was that still in the car?
Some of it. So some of it was left in the car and some of it was not.
Now that's interesting.
Very interesting. So, you know, if she was running away, why would she take a bag full of liquor? Like how far could she run with that? And if she ditched it, why didn't we ever find it? So that's always been something that...
Was there any broken bottles found near where the car was found?
No.
Okay, because I'm thinking maybe that there was some sort of struggle, right? And well, we'll get into the military part in just a minute and all of her training too, which I'm very curious about. But so let's get back to this bus driver, because he's always been a question in my mind. A lot of times when someone doesn't want to be a suspect, they insert themselves into the investigation. So was his house ever searched? And what do we know about his background? Was that ever looked into? What do we know about him?
Yeah, so he he does not have a, did not have a criminal background that I know of. But law enforcement did speak to him. My father spoke to him. And he allegedly took two polygraph tests and he failed one. And then he passed the second one. But what's always been curious to me about what he did that night was he drove his bus back to his house, and you could sort of see, depending on how heavy the snow was or how the snow sat on the trees, you could see from his porch to where Mara's car was. It was a direct line of sight. So he backs his bus into his driveway, and you know, technically he could see, he had a line of sight to the Saturn. But then once the responding officer showed up on scene, they went to the Westman's house. They were the older couple that lived across the street, and talked to them. And then the officer's name was Cecil Smith. He went to the bus driver's house. And the bus driver voluntarily, as I understand, jumped in his Bronco and said, "Hey, I'll help you search." And that's always been curious to me.
Why would he say that just out of the blue? That's so strange. That's so strange.
Right. Yeah. I don't know.
Because he's assuming that someone is missing, yet he wouldn't have known that yet at that time.
Well, other than he's the one that spoke to Mara at the car. So then Mara was at the car. He goes to his house, parks his bus. Then the cops, Cecil Smith, comes and says, "Where is she?" And he's like, I just spoke to her minutes ago. I don't know.
And then he says the lie about the cell phone and that she just called, which is either her lie or his lie. But it's a lie.
It's a lie, yeah. I never thought of it as potentially his lie, because the only source of that information is him.
Right.
Yeah. I never really thought of it that way.
So we have him that is possibly a smoker, possibly seen by the couple. He admits to his interaction with her, and then his account that she called, which she didn't call and couldn't have called. And then he tells police, "I'm going to help you. I'm going to search for her to get away from the area." So all of that, that's strange to me.
I agree. The couple has gone on record and said that they did see the bus stop right in front of the abandoned car. Or no, it wasn't abandoned at that time, but it stopped in the middle of the road. And so that blocked their line of sight because the car was on the other side of the bus. Yeah.
And this is in kind of a rural area, right? You've been there. Can you please paint me a picture of what the street looks like? Like, it's just a few houses, correct?
Yeah, it's a few houses. It's a lot of times people think of it as this remote area. It was headed towards the National Forest. So it was headed towards the White Mountains and the Lincoln area. But to get from where Mara was to that area, you had to go through this stretch of miles and miles where there's nothing. But where Mara's crashed, there were several houses. There are several houses.
Now let's look at the older couple across the street. Was there potentially anyone else in that house with them?
No.
Okay, was there anyone else on the street?
Yeah, there was another house on the side of the street that Mara's car was found, which was headed towards Lincoln. They also saw, they didn't come out of their house, but the gentleman, Mr. Marat, John Marat, he saw taillights, like Mara was trying to reverse. So that's what he saw. And then further down, there was another house that was Rick Forcier's house. He was the witness that said months later that he noticed somebody that fit Mara's description running down the road 5 miles towards that Lincoln area in that more remote section of the road that I described.
Would she have been able to run in the snow?
No. He later recanted that and said it may not, he didn't stop, it may not have been her. So we don't know.
That's strange. He puts himself in the story, kind of makes up something, takes it back. That's just weird.
Yes.
What was going on in Mara's life at the time? Was she dating somebody? We know she was in college. Paint me a picture of what you know that she shared with you.
Yeah, so Mara and I were really close. I went to West Point and Mara followed in my footsteps, joined me there. However, the structured lifestyle and military regimen was not for her. So she left and went to the University of Massachusetts. And she was admitted into the nursing program, which is really competitive and a really difficult program. So she's in the nursing program. Our mother was a nurse, so she was following in my mother's footsteps and going to clinicals. And she had two jobs. She was dating a man that she met at West Point. So there was a long distance relationship. He was in Oklahoma. She's at UMass, you know, college stressors, you know, just the normal stuff, having no money and trying to scrape by. And, you know, she, 2 days before this accident, she was at, like I said earlier, a dorm room party. And she took my dad's new car and got into a car accident. So that was on Saturday night. So two car accidents in a very short amount of time. So she was stressed, I think, more than the average person.
Okay, so what came to mind when you were telling me that she went to the liquor store and she was going to all these places that she'd been in the past that she may have known was that maybe she was planning a surprise for the boyfriend. Were they planning to meet up there for the weekend or something?
No, I know that that's a definitive no, because he was in the military just like I was. We were lieutenants. He was stationed at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. When you're a lieutenant in the military, you're brand new. You're the bottom of the totem pole. Like, you can't just leave. You have no freedom. You've got to get passes and permission, and you have to build up your leave. It's like when you start a new job, you need to, you know, put your time in to get your leave and get that privilege. We didn't have that as lieutenants. So Bill would have had, her boyfriend's name was Bill, he would have had to have put leave in advance to be able to do a, you know, get a flight or drive to New Hampshire to meet Mara. Mara could have jumped in a car and tried to drive to Oklahoma, but that's opposite the direction she went. So I don't think she was meeting Bill. Now, that's not to say that she wasn't meeting someone. However, no one has come forward in almost 18 years saying, yes, I was going to go meet Mara and we had a plan to meet here at this time. So what I've always thought was she was stressed. Like, she just crashed my dad's car. We hated to disappoint my dad. And so I think she was just, you know, at her breaking point to where she was like, I need to go get away. Take some time for myself. And go to a familiar place that she was comfortable with.
As one of the first true crime cases of the modern social media era, it has one with everyone with their own theories on this one, right? Where was Mara going? And what happened after she crashed her car?
Okay, I want to talk to you about the theories now. What you think is ridiculous, what has been disproven, and what you think is still possible. So if you can, please share with me what you feel comfortable in sharing and all of that, because I know some people have said that they have maybe seen her in Canada. Some people say that this is a perfect recipe for someone that just wants to leave their own life behind. So what is in all of these, lack of a better way to put it, conspiracy theories, and how that doesn't help you? Please talk to me about that.
Yeah. Well, let me preface this by saying I can't rule out any possibilities. Everything must be on the table until we have some more definitive evidence. And that's not to say that law enforcement doesn't already have that, but they have not shared that with my family. And they certainly have not shared that with the public. So that's very important to start, because people criticize others by saying, you know, we can't rule anything out. And I'm the first to tell you, yeah, I'm with you on that. I don't know where she is. You know, I don't know what happened, but there's three main theories that have kind of been bounced around. One being suicide. So she was going up there to end her life. I think that one's unlikely because I am one of the few people on planet Earth that knew Mara. You know, I knew Mara. I knew her personality. That was not her personality. If you're going to go commit suicide, do you hand in your homework? You don't turn your homework in. And she took her textbooks with her and her running shoes. Those are probably the two most important things. Mara was a standout athlete and an extremely intelligent student, you know, and she was doing great in the nursing program. So she took those two things. She also took her birth control. So I think that is unlikely. And plus, there was no footprints in the snow, and where's her body? Right. So the second theory is that she was going to meet someone. I think it's telling that not a single person has come forward and said, yes, it was me. We talked about it. We were going to go meet in New Hampshire. This was our plan. So that person hasn't surfaced. And there's no evidence of it. And the couple that saw Mara said that, you know, they did say they saw a man smoking a cigarette. Well, who was that man? You know, but then the bus driver said it was just a single female. So it's conflicting information and we don't have any evidence to point towards that.
Unless he's the man that was smoking the cigarette.
Yeah, exactly. And the third major theory is that she was picked up by somebody and then met with foul play. So that would be why there was no footprints in the snow. None of her personal belongings have been found. The alcohol bottle, the book bag, the keys, the cell phone, her wallet, nothing. Nothing has ever been found that we know of. Law enforcement may not know something that I don't. Also, for that third theory, to support that third theory is the fact that when the scent dogs arrived on the scene, they tracked Mara's scent up the road towards the bus driver's house, towards Lincoln. And then all of a sudden the dogs lost the scent in the middle of the road. So that's all we have to go on. So, you know, again, I don't know what happened and I don't know which theory is, you can't rule out any theory until we find her. But the third one seems most plausible to me.
The same bus driver that failed one lie detector test that we know of, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does he still live there?
The bus driver and his Commonwealth wife moved to Florida about a year after the disappearance. So 2005 timeframe. I have to fact check myself on that, but it was pretty close. Moved to Florida and then he never spoke really about Mara to anybody and then he passed away.
So I didn't plan to focus so much on him just in talking to you. I just have so many questions about that interaction.
Now, I will tell you that when my dad spoke to him, my dad, you know, he was a bigger guy. He was clinically obese. Older guy, had a, you know, a big beard, big belly. The rumor was he was a hoarder. Now his common law wife lived with him and was in the house when all of this happened, as well as his mother. So there was two other people in the house at the same time during that night, February 9th. So we have that as well. But when my dad talked to him, my dad said he didn't, you know, he's just nervous and my dad believed him.
Where do you think the investigation needs to go? It's been some time, which doesn't help. Now, in searching and looking, you seem very dedicated to your sister's case. And I know that it's been hard to talk about. So what can you share?
Yeah, no, here's the deal. With cases like this, unsolved cases, if we don't talk about it, then my sister becomes a file in a cabinet, right? So I have to bring her to the public's attention. I have to keep her out there. And as painful as that is sometimes, you know, it's like ripping the Band-Aid off. You think you're like getting closer to healing some of the trauma, and then you got to talk about it again, but you have to do it. Otherwise, you know, the case is never going to get solved. And that person out there that may know a little something that think, oh, well, that's insignificant. You know, what if we get five pieces of insignificant, unrelated, unconnected tips, and then somebody connects them all, and then bam, we solved the case. So it's just part of what we have to do. And my family, you know, we don't have a choice. She would do it for us. My sister would do this for me. So I'm doing it for her. And there's absolutely nothing that's going to stop me from keeping doing it. I'm not going to feel sorry for myself. None of that. But to get back to your question about the investigation, this is always a challenge for me because law enforcement shares so little. So I don't know what's been investigated and what hasn't. My dad sued the state of New Hampshire for the case files because he felt that they weren't doing a thorough job because there were several things that weren't followed up on, like people Mara called like the week of the disappearance had never been spoken to until several months later. And that was only when my family called them. So little things like that really angered us and frustrated us. So my dad sued the state of New Hampshire for the case files. And they said that they could not release the case files because it was an open investigation. So it's hard to say, you know, where do we go? So from my family perspective, you know, I run a website. We have a family tip line and we get tips in a lot. A lot of them are dead ends, but it only takes one. So that's kind of what we rely on now. But yeah, I mean, like we talked about before, I think those critical hours after the crash that nothing happened until my dad showed up really hurt us.
And when we're talking about the different theories and what may have happened to her, in those moments, if she was abducted, she's also trained, right? She's a fighter because she was military. Is that fair to say? She would have put up a fight. She would have. And what I'm getting at is maybe there is something that someone may have noticed around that time and maybe didn't report, because maybe there was an injury to a guy during around that time and someone noticed it and he was in that area.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. So in order to get into West Point, obviously you have to be in pretty good shape, which Mara was, and we were distance runners, and Mara was, you know, she ran at nationals and was 33 in the nation in the 2 miles. So you're not going to outrun Mara, right? You know, she's going to get away. That's her number one line of defense. She's going to take off and no one's going to catch her for miles. However, she was scrappy too. I mean, we both played basketball, soccer, softball, every sport you can imagine. We wrestled each other, you know, really like relentlessly. Like we would beat up on each other. So we grew up sort of with that physicality already ingrained in us, but then when we went to West Point, now we're holding rifles and we've got to do marksmanship training, combat, survival swimming, land navigation. Now it's just, you know, the basics of those things, you know, basic, marksmanship. So it's not like she was an expert in any of those one things, but she was exposed to a number of different, skills that, you know, a normal college kid wouldn't be exposed to. So I'm putting my money on Mara. Like if she was in a fight, you know, good luck. I do know that the responding officer called into the local hospital, but he asked if a woman was there. I don't believe that they ever looked into if a man was there. That's a very good point.
The case has been the subject of books, podcasts, and documentaries, which has become a double-edged sword for Julie and the rest of her family just searching for answers.
Her case, as you know, is an armchair detectives type case that has driven through the internet, and you run the website, you run the Facebook, you know all that. Talk to me about that. Is it helping or hurting the case? I hope it's helping, because people can anonymously say something if they do know something.
Yeah, for the most part, the social media aspect and the online community has helped. It has helped with awareness. And like I said, awareness for missing persons cases are the number one thing. When people ask me, hey, what can I do to help? I say, keep talking about Mara, like get her face out there, spread her name. You know, somebody knows something. We just need to shake the right tree to get the right information and get these puzzle pieces to fall and then connect them. Since Mara's case is so mysterious and we know so little and law enforcement has shared so little, it's a storyteller's dream. So there's so many gaps that you could literally fill in 10 different stories just with whatever speculation you want to and steer that story wherever you want to steer it to. And so some of the steering has steered the story towards, first dehumanizing Mara, sort of saying, putting on public display all of her missteps as a 21-year-old kid. I'm glad no one did that to me because, I was an idiot. Like, I didn't know anything when I was 21. I don't want that stuff all over the internet. Stuff that's not in the public interest for finding a missing person, like sexual history. Why do we need to know? We don't. Why is that on the internet? Mental, her eating disorder, her disordered eating. Why is that on the internet? Things like that. So, that's sort of the first thing people do is dehumanize Mara so that they can rationalize exploiting her to make it a better story, because it's more salacious that way if we talk about her sexual history. People cast aspersions on my family and say, oh, they're mysterious. Like they didn't respond the way that they should have, or, they didn't say the right thing. I've been accused of saying the wrong words all the time. I'm like, I'm not trained in this. I just have a missing sister. I'm just trying to do my best to keep her name out there. I'm going to say the wrong thing sometimes. That doesn't mean that I'm hiding information or I know what happened to her. I would not be putting myself through this if I did. And then discrediting people that try to help my family. So there's been a lot of volunteers that have spent their own money and their own time just to try to help. And by doing that, they've now exposed themselves to the way that social media has been used as sort of a public shaming tool. And it's all to, be relevant or use Mara's case as a cash cow to launch your career and things like that. And it's really disgusting, unethical behavior. And that's something that I'm trying to speak out against and prevent. The damage is done in my sister's case. I'm on my soapbox with this, but it's just sickening behavior because, people use the internet to anonymously troll and, distract. And that's the main thing. And so it's gotten so bad that, the main discussions on Mara Murray forums have nothing to do with Mara Murray.
Well, I'm glad that you brought that up because I hope people think before they post. And I find having been a broadcaster for 20 something years, women get the brunt of it and the attacks and the trolling online the most. And notice I didn't ask you about that stuff because I don't feel that it's appropriate. I don't think that it helps the case. But I'm glad that you brought it up so that people that seem to think that it's okay to bring these things up will think twice. And I'm sorry that this has happened to your family.
Yeah, and my main message there is, I more than anyone want to find my sister. And if we think talking about her eating disorder is going to help us find her, let's talk about it. But I don't see how it's relevant. Also, people forget that my sister was a real person and my family is, we're real. We're not these characters, and things that are said that aren't said with compassion and empathy hurt us. Like, you're hurting us by doing this. We're already hurting enough. Like, we've had our share of trauma. And by adding this additional trauma on top of the trauma that we're already trying our best to deal with is hurting us.
Let's hope for the best. Hope that she's still with us. What's your message to her?
My message is I love you. We love you. I am going to find you. I am not going to quit. My, all of us, my dad, my brothers, we're not going to quit. And if you're out there, we're going to find you.
And your message to someone who, I don't know, is listening and knows something?
I keep urging people, come forward if you think you know anything, even if it's insignificant, because we're missing some pieces here. And once we get those few missing pieces, we can put this puzzle together and maybe get closer to answers. You know, there's no closure for us. You know, that's not possible. But we could get answers, and then answers can lead to a resolution. And so that's all I'm asking people to do is, you know, maybe you drove by the scene, or maybe you drove by a side street, or maybe you noticed something days leading up or days after that may be significant to putting this puzzle together.
It's those small details that you don't realize add up and they fill in the blanks. And it's exactly like what you're talking about. You're so schooled in this, unfortunately, because you've had to become an investigator yourself all of these years.
Yeah, and one thing I wanna piggyback on that. Someone asked me a question one time, and I didn't realize it, but my outlook on the world has become so morbid because I'm like, oh, like you could put a body there, like, oh, you could hide something there, and it's just like, whoa, this is like, I didn't even realize that I have become that. But when you're in my situation, you have to, especially when I'm up in that area, I'm just, you know, looking at everything, noticing everything, and that stuff weighs on you.
I'm sure it weighs on your whole family, especially everything that you talked about. And also, this is one of the biggest cases in the true crime world. Is there anything new in the case?
Well, we did have, there was a discovery of some human remains up in Loon Mountain, which is about 25 miles from where Maura's car was found. And that was back in August. I might be wrong. But anyway, in the fall. So that was kind of a little close for us. So we thought, oh, you know, this could be her. Like, this could be it. Like, so of course it took forever, but they tested the bones and they said it didn't fit into the right time frame for those to be Maura. So that's been the sort of the latest news. Other than that, we're just getting local tips and people trying to, you know, put things together. But nothing, law enforcement hasn't come to me and said, hey, you know, we're working this lead and we think it's promising. So we don't know.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you?
Just thank you.
Thank you for joining me and sharing your story. Please keep us posted.
Maura Marie disappeared in February of 2004 after crashing her Saturn on Route 112 in North Haverhill, New Hampshire. For more information, including photos of Maura, you can go to our website, truecrimedeadline.com, or mauramurraymissing.org. You can also leave a tip on that website, or just simply call police. Let's get this case solved. It's been 18 years. Investigators, until next time.
Thank you for investigating True Crime Deadline with Matt Johnson. For more information about the podcast, visit truecrimedeadline.com. And remember, all tips regarding a case should go to the police. Until next time.
This season dedicated to my best friend, my French bulldog, my crime-fighting canine, Mr. Gatsby, who is now in doggy heaven. From both of us, please hug your pet tonight.
Mr. Gatsby, want a cookie? Good boy.
Now a post-episode shout-out to investigators who wrote reviews on Apple Podcasts. Again, writing reviews really helps independent podcasts like this one get noticed. We're up against networks, studios, TV channels, so thank you. It's easy, it's free. Just hit 5 stars, subscribe, tell a friend, write a review, and leave your real name or your podcast name if you're a podcaster, because I want to give you a proper shout out. This review comes from someone named Grandma, and they have heart emojis, and it just says love. with 5 stars. Thank you for the love for me and Mr. Gatsby at this point in time. Investigators, until next time.